disappear. It keeps me up at night. There are
Welcome to The Wire, Community and Indigenous Radio's National Independent Current Affairs Program. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide. Today, Indigenous Disadvantage Scorecard shows self-determination and community-led programs are key to success. Employment Without Barriers aims to eradicate ableism in the workplace. The space race is back on as China lands on the moon. And straight from the bush, Indigenous artists showcase their wares in Adelaide. Stay with us for the next half hour. First up, joining me in the studio with the latest news headlines is Michael McGarley.
First to COVID news. So worldwide, we've reached 64.4 million cases with up to 1.5 million deaths. Australia has just over 27,900 cases with 908 deaths. South Australia have recorded no new cases today, but there are still 9 active cases across the state. The Northern Territory government has announced 6 new cases today, all of which have come from repatriation flights landing in Darwin. All of those who tested positive are currently in quarantine. Victoria have again recorded no new cases. After New South Wales went 26 days without a locally acquired case, a Sydney hotel quarantine worker has tested positive for COVID. New South Wales Health have actually released the public transport trips taken by the hotel quarantine worker. So from Friday the 27th of November to Monday the 30th, the person travelled on the train from Minto to Central, and on the light rail they travelled between Central and Darling Harbour. Despite the new case, Queensland's border with Greater Sydney and Victoria will remain open after border restrictions in the state were eased yesterday. And Queensland has had only one new case overnight, which came from an overseas arrival. There are currently 8 active cases in the state.
News of a vaccine approval in the UK has come earlier than expected, and there's a flow-on impact for Australia.
Yeah, so Federal Treasurer Josh Frydenberg says that the early arrival would provide a $34 billion boost to the economy. Frydenberg said that initially the assumption in the budget was that a vaccine would arrive by the end of 2021. Frydenberg also said that Australia has its own regulation processes which vaccines must pass. However, based on current estimates, a vaccine could be approved by as early as January.
We've been a little bit quiet about the US election this week, but there's been some news.
So one of Donald Trump's closest allies says that there has been no evidence of voter fraud. Republicans have also got the ball rolling on their challenges to the election results in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. They have taken their allegations of voter fraud in Pennsylvania to the US Supreme Court after their case was rejected by the highest court in the state over the weekend. Their argument is that Pennsylvania's vote-by-mail law is unconstitutional because it required a constitutional amendment to be authorized. Trump lost the state by over 80,000 votes.
Finally, Iran's parliament have approved a law to stop UN inspections of its nuclear program, as well as increasing its uranium enrichment. That is, if crippling sanctions against the country are not lifted.
Yes, so the bill would require the government to continue enriching uranium to 20%, which is far more than the 3.67% agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal. This comes after the targeted killing of Iran's top nuclear scientist, who had a central role in the nuclear program. Iran blames Israel and an exiled opposition group for the attack. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says he opposes the implementation of the new law. Iran has been subjected to strong sanctions by the West aimed at preventing it from developing nuclear weapons.
The Overcoming Indigenous Disadvantage Report measures the well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, providing the most comprehensive and up-to-date findings on our First Nations peoples' well-being. The report is produced by the Productivity Commission, and this year marks its 8th iteration since 2003, with a particular focus on decision-making between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and the government. Commissioner Romley Mokak is a Dukan man and a member of the Yawuru people. He reveals the key findings of this year's report to The Wire's Soph Landau.
In terms of improvement, In the area of early childhood development, we've seen some really good improvements. So mortality rates, for example, for children have decreased, and particularly in that 0 to 1 year old period, those mortality rates have decreased by about 60%, so more than halved. Education, similarly, completion of year 12, the data showing that a high proportion of Aboriginal young people are completing year 12. In terms of the areas that haven't improved so much, and these are areas of great concern, the rates of children in out-of-home care, and those rates have tripled over the last 15 years. The proportion of adults as well who are reporting high to very high levels of psychological distress have increased over the last 10, 15 years. So if we're to improve outcomes and tackle these issues, we need to have Aboriginal people, Torres Strait Islander people, in the decision-making processes equally with government.
Often we do hear that self-determination and community-controlled programs generate better success in the community, as you say. So is there evidence in the report that backs that up?
We have 10 case studies that are a good way of sharing what's going on around the country. So in most jurisdictions, there are really strong attempts at trying to bring these things together. Some of them are in development, but others are showing some really good outcomes. Some of the work that's happening, for example, in Victoria through the Aboriginal Children's Forum, where government, ACOs, the Aboriginal Community Controlled Organisations in Victoria, and non-government organisations, the non-Indigenous, non-government organisations, will often be those who are case managing Aboriginal children through the system. But in terms of out-of-home care and child protection, have a look at the Aboriginal Children's Forum as a piece of architecture and relationships that show some really great promise.
In the areas which have regressed, have any contributing factors been identified?
So the areas, as I've mentioned, the out-of-home care, the rates haven't increased for Aboriginal people as they haven't with non-Indigenous people. But once in the system, you can see the increase in terms of Aboriginal children moving into the out-of-home care system or under care and protection orders. And what we're seeing is that correspondingly, Aboriginal kids in that system are then losing that connection with their kinship networks. So there's a decrease in our communities and our kinship and our families looking after those kids. So there's something going on structurally there that needs to be really looked at. In terms of the high rates of psychological distress, high rates of suicide, there are many and varied factors. One of the things that we point to, you know, is the importance of recognising context, the importance of understanding historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, and how that plays out and into a contemporary view of the world, but also the lived experience of people. We also, in this report, identify that there are a number of areas that need to be addressed, including ensuring access to culturally safe services, for example. So if people are feeling and experiencing psychological distress at such high levels, the lack of access to culturally safe services is a real problem. So services in the right place at the right time, suited for that local context. Another point that I'd make is that the need to address racism and discrimination more broadly, but also within institutions, is absolutely critical.
Romley Mokak, Productivity Commissioner, on the Overcoming Indigenous Disadvantage Report, speaking with The Wire's Soph Landau. It's an exciting week in space news with the first moon landing in decades and an asteroid destined to arrive in South Australia. The Wire's Cassie Taylor has the story.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It's been a long time since we heard about moon landings, but on Wednesday, China's Chang'e 5 robotic spacecraft did just that. It's the first mission to collect lunar samples and bring them back to Earth since 1976. China's National Space Administration reports the spacecraft will drill into the moon's surface and collect around 2 kilograms of moon rocks before sending them back to Earth. To find out more about why this mission took place and the significance of the landing for China, I spoke with Paul Curnow, astronomy lecturer at the University of South Australia's Adelaide Planetarium.
China wants to demonstrate its technological abilities as a stepping stone to eventually putting people back on the moon and on Mars. And I think they really want to show the US and Russia, the former Soviet Union, that they're going to be a very big player in the space program. China's become the third nation to basically successfully put a spacecraft on the moon. The Americans are looking very seriously. They want people back on the moon by the year 2024. So, you know, about 4 years, and we should be seeing people hopefully walking on the lunar surface again. And when the Americans go back, this will be hopefully a permanent base. So much like the Cold War, when the former Soviet Union and United States were competing against each other in the technological sense, I think China's now taking the place, if you like, of the Soviet Union against the US, saying, well, look, you know, we're going to put people on the moon and we can send probes to Mars, so on, because this is all eventually a stepping stone to sending people off to the red planet Mars. And the Americans have a very ambitious program of having someone on Mars by the year 2033.
Paul says this particular mission could reveal information about the history of the moon that hasn't been discovered on any of the previous occasions.
When the Americans went there over 50 years ago with the Apollo program, a lot of the sites they landed at, the surface rocks were very old. I think they were around the 3.2 billion year old mark. Where the Chinese have landed, the rocks we think are probably around the 1.2 billion year old mark. Now that's still very old, but we think this may be one of the last sites of active volcanism on the moon. And so the moon being a smaller body cooled quicker than the Earth, so it'll be able to teach us more about the way bodies form in the solar system, when the moon formed, and so forth.
Staying on the subject of space, we couldn't let the significant event of an asteroid landing in South Australia pass us by, marking the second ever successful collection of an asteroid sample. Here's Paul Curnow again.
This Sunday, Japanese have the Hayabusa spacecraft returning to the Earth. This is a very ambitious program where Japanese sent a spacecraft down to touch down on the surface of an asteroid, collect a sample, and that sample is landing in South Australia at the Woomera Test Facility. And again, you know, looking at these asteroids, we're able to determine more about the way the solar system's formed and so on by, because this is a carbonaceous type asteroid, so it's preserved a lot of the minerals from the ice and organic molecules, compounds that have formed early when the solar system's formed.
Paul Curnow, astronomy lecturer at Uni SA's Adelaide Planetarium, speaking with The Wire's Cassie Taylor.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
Today is International Day of People with Disability, and this year's theme is about seeing the ability in disability. One of the many challenges affecting those in the disability community as a whole is ableism, particularly for those who face employment discrimination, stigma, and bias. Recently, Life Without Barriers launched their Employment Without Barriers campaign to encourage employers to improve their recruitment practices so that they can open doors to a more equitable, accessible and inclusive workplace. Emily Reaper is the Project Officer of Disability Engagement. She explained what the campaign is aiming to do to The Wire's Jared McLaughlin.
So the Employment Without Barriers campaign actually came about through what we call our AIEP, which is our Accessibility Inclusion Employment Plan. Our AIEP lists specific targets and actions for the organisation to meet in our journey to becoming a more inclusive employer. And through that journey, we're on our second AIEP, I should mention, we decided that we needed to share our learnings with the wider community, so our sector, but also other sectors within society. So because of that, we decided to pull together the Employment Without Barriers campaign, which we have shared on our website, where any employers can go and look on that website and find some of the information that we've shared. So our commitment, our position paper, things that we found have worked for us along the way. Just trying to give other employers a bit of a better foot to start on.
Where do you think that employers are doing wrong in terms of not making their workplaces accessible or inclusive for disabled people?
The word wrong is a hard one. I think one thing that a lot of employers tend to not see or too quick to judge is the fact that having a person with a disability work for you is going to be difficult, it's going to be harder, you're going to have to make sacrifices. Or there's the other side of they just don't know how. They just don't know how to interact with someone with a disability, or they've never worked with someone with a disability. And I think that the number one thing that employers can start doing is opening that door and having those conversations, asking people with disabilities what they can do to help them in the workplace. You know, what do you need? And then meet them there. So just having that conversation, opening it up and not being afraid to say to someone with a disability applying for a job, you know, how, you know, we would like you to work for us. How can we make this more inclusive workplace for you? And going down that path.
And where do you think that businesses, organisations or industries can go about changing and improving their policies, frameworks and practices in recruiting disabled people to their workplaces?
There's a lot of change that needs to happen in the recruitment space, and I think that's something that we're looking at as part of our Employment Without Barriers campaign is, you know, how do we do that ourselves? I mean, you automatically know that with a lot of people with disabilities, they're automatically ruled out of a job because one of the main requirements is having the license, even though it may not be an integral part to the role. I think what employers need to start doing is, you know, really thinking about the necessities of those roles and what is actually needed, you know, not being afraid to relook at the roles and make a change because it's been the same for the last 20 years.
How can we go about educating employers to not use ableist language, rhetoric or ideologies?
So it's by looking at our website, the Employment Without Barriers campaign. We share some tips and tricks on there as well. I think employers just need to start speaking to other organisations that know what they're doing, reach out to organisations like the Australian Network on Disability and learn a little bit more about what is actually classified as ableism and what... Because I think some employers don't really understand that some of the language they use is actually classified as that, or they think that, you know, what they're doing is okay. It's this idea of, I'm not sure if you've heard of it, but it's the benevolence bias. It's this idea that we think we're doing the right thing by supporting someone with a disability, but in fact, by doing that, we're hindering them. So I think employers need to start kind of questioning that themselves, thinking how that what that means to them, and reaching out to organisations and looking at things like the Employment Without Barriers campaign to start making those small changes in their organisation.
Emily Reaper, Project Officer of Disability Engagement at Life Without Barriers, speaking with The Wire's Jared McLaughlin. The annual Tarnandi Art Fair is set to open its doors in Adelaide this weekend. Hosting a vast collection of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artworks from all over the country. Unlike previous years, curators have included an online exhibition space alongside the in-person fair, so people from all around Australia can get involved. While the Tarnandi Art Fair is a great way to immerse yourself in the culture of First Nations people, it is also an opportunity to ethically support these talented artists. Nikki Cumpston is the Artistic Director of the Tarnandi Festival, and Cade McDonald is CEO of Agency, an organisation that liaises between artists and the Art Gallery of South Australia. They joined The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg to discuss the challenges they faced pulling together this year's art fair.
I feel really grateful that we were able to design a COVID-safe event to be able to support the artists to bring all of their work down and for us to be able to sell it for them this year. It's just quite miraculous, really, that we've been able to do it.
What is it like curating a fair on both an online platform and in person?
Well, it's been interesting because it's not something that we've done previously. So we'll be the people that are talking about the artists and sharing all of their deep and rich stories and their incredible works of art that are available for sale.
What have the challenges and what have the highlights been curating the fair this year?
It's been a first for everyone. So it's been a privilege to talk to all those art centres and all those artists and support them in curating their stock. You know, we can't take as much stock as what has been brought in the past. So we've really had to refine it and create a really great experience for the viewer to come in and see the diversity, you know, all the different mediums from fibre work to acrylic on canvas to works on bark, all across from Torres Strait Island all the way down to southeastern Australia. You know, it's been challenging, but it's also been quite an amazing privilege.
Could you speak to the importance of this kind of platform for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island artists, particularly with COVID as a factor?
This is an incredible chance for all of us to support them and to show our support by buying original works of art. And it just brings so much joy when you walk into the space and you see all of that creativity and, you know, there's really nuanced works and unique things that you won't find anywhere else.
You know, these fairs that happen throughout the year, and Tanandi being one of those key moments, is aside from, you know, the audiences and people coming together, it's a great opportunity for artists to see family that they may not have seen. They all congregate, they tell each other stories, they sort of bounce off each other in terms of the challenges and the opportunities that art centres face. So they're really amazing networking and kingship opportunities for these artists to get together. So the online space has been remarkable, you know, unique visitors from all over the world that haven't had that chance to go in person in the past. So that's been great. But nothing kind of beats, you know, seeing that work in person, having that experience, learning what you can from it, and then, you know, taking it home and having a piece of that generosity that those artists have given out. That's stories of country, that's stories of place, that's the heart and soul of this nation.
Online sales have already opened. Have you guys had any engagement with that yet?
Yeah, numbers are great. You know, people are going through that portal, buying stuff, getting feedback from art centres who are making some really good, crucial sales in the lead up to Christmas. But this is a showcase of great resilience and innovation that happens even in the midst of those moments of isolation and lockdown.
What are you anticipating in-person engagement to be like this year?
Well, we've got restrictions with our numbers, but we've got lots of people on deck to support the check-in of everyone as they enter. And we feel that there are lots of us to support and enable people to understand what it is that they're looking at and give them a bit of insight. You know, we feel really positive about it because we've put everything in place that we need to in order to be running a COVID-safe event.
What has consulting and supporting artists been like for you in this turbulent year?
The immediate thing is the challenges of travel. Normally, we'd move around and see a lot of these communities and these artists face to face. But again, you know, that capacity to adjust and sort of adapt, I think that's a really important thing that's been important coming out of community for a long time. But I'd like to echo what Nikki was saying, you know, the enthusiasm and the symbolic thing of this fair that we can do it in person is that the communities and the art centres are just so excited by that. They can't be here, which is a real shame, but I think to celebrate the interface, see people through social media engaging, buying, picking things up is just a really important thing to finish this year.
Why is this fair so significant on both a local and national level?
This fair is about celebrating the richest cultural history, identity, place of this country. You know, it's a fair and you can buy something, but it's also an experience of you being absorbed and engaging in something that is so important in this nation's identity. And these are the people, these are the voices, these are the hands that create that identity of our countries. It's an amazing showcase of the diversity of Indigenous Australians.
What makes the fair a more ethical way to purchase Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander artwork?
All of the works of art have come directly from artists through their art centres, and these are organisations that support the work of artists in their community for them to be able to live and work in community, and quite often are the only source of income that people have within their community. All of the sales go directly back to the artists and the art centres. We don't take any commission fee, and we also support them to freight the work down.
One thing to note about Indigenous art centres is that they are, in most cases in these remote spaces, the independent income stream for a lot of people. Everyone's had a tough year, and even if it wasn't a tough year, this is a great time to get a little bit of a bonus before Christmas, support the family back home, support the broader community. All of these art centres and the fair itself are partners and members of the Art Code, the Indigenous Art Code, which is an ethical governing body, so you know that your money is going somewhere really great.
Nikki Cumston, Artistic Director of the Tanandi Festival, and Cade McDonald, CEO of Agency, speaking with The Wire's Ayla Liebenberg. The Tanani Art Fair will be open from the 4th to the 6th of December at Lot 14 in Adelaide, and you can find the link to the online exhibition at The Wire's website. That's all for The Wire today. If you'd like to hear any of our stories again, head to our website, thewire.org.au. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for The Wire Radio. This program is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane, and we're produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us through your radio or on our podcast every weekday across Australia on the Community Radio Network. Today's show came from the studios of Radio Adelaide on Kaurna Country. I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for joining us.
Lines of coke and soda.